Good evening and welcome to Behind the News for September 29, 2005. This is Doug Henwood, and we're looking, as we do most weeks, at this time at the worlds of economics and politics. I've got two interviews lined up for tonight. First, in about 5 minutes or so, I'll be talking to Kurt Davies, who is the research director at Greenpeace, about global warming and Katrina and Rita and specifically an angle that Greenpeace has been working on and off over the years. Trying to get the insurance industry on the side of doing something about climate change issues. They have to pay out a lot of big claims. You might think that they would be concerned about climate change. Are they? Well, not really, is the message, at least not the U.S. insurance industry. But we'll hear more on that from Kurt Davies in a little bit. And then at the bottom of the hour, Larry Bartels, who's a political scientist at Princeton, talking about a paper he did recently, or some work he's done, on investigating the truth, or the lack of the famous thesis that cultural issues have been encouraging members of the white working class to vote for Republicans and against their material interests. Is this true? And is there really something the matter with Kansas? Larry Bartels will be addressing that issue in about half an hour or so. First, a look at the economic headlines. Something I do every quarter when the right numbers come out is take a look at what's happening with the profitability of U.S. corporations. As any Marxist school child knows, the rate of profit is the driving motor of the capitalist system. Any kind of economic activity is undertaken only if it will generate a sufficient profit, and when the general rate of profit is high, the economy looks healthy, the capitalist class is happy, and in general, we've, in theory at least, the economy, whatever that abstraction means exactly, is doing well. When the profit rate is down, it's times of retrenchment, unemployment, inflation, austerity, bad times in general, the rate of profit was very, very high in the 1950s and 1960s. It would go down in recessions to the 6 or 7% range and up to about, in a really good time, in the peak in the mid-1960s, about 11%. And I'm measuring this rate of profit by looking at the profits generated by corporations that are outside finance, non-financial corporations, the theory being that finance just redistributes value that is created in the non-financial sector, the production of real goods and services. We take that those profits and divide them by the value of the corporate capital stock, the value of the accumulated investments in machinery and equipment owned by U.S. Non-financial corporations. This is a very standard calculation to figure out the rate of return on their invested capital. And as I said, during the 1950s and 1960s, that rate was generally hovered between 8 and 10%. It took a very, very steep dive in the crises of the 1970s. And bottomed out in the early 1980s at about 4%, that is the profit rate before taxes. So from a peak of about 11% in the mid-1960s to a trough of about 4% before taxes in the end of 1982. 1982 was really when Reaganism took its full effect, and the current neoliberal era of hypercharged, turbocharged capitalism really began its run. The stock market took off. The working class really started taking it in the chin. And the rate of profit, though, climbed pretty steadily throughout the 1980s and then into the boom of the 1990s. And it really recovered about three-quarters of the decline that it experienced from the mid-1960s through the early 1980s. Got up to a little over 8% in 1997. Curiously, the rate of profit peaked in 1997, about 3 years before the broad economy did, before the stock market did, before the NASDAQ bubble burst in 2000. So that was a sign that things were starting to go rather sour on the 1990s boom. And it took a very, very steep dive back down to the depths of the early 1980s, pretty close. To around 4 or 5%, but it's been recovering very dramatically ever since, and it's now pushing 8% once again, and that's what it was in the second quarter, very close to 8%, and really that is matching the highs of the 1990s or very close to them, and really kind of back to the golden age levels of the 1950s or 1960s, or rather close to it. But what's interesting about it this time is that even though employment and wages, employment is expanding and wages were rising in the 50s and 1960s, and even in the late 1990s they were doing that, that's not really what's happening this time. Employment is growing very, very slowly. Wages are barely growing at all, and maybe declining if you adjust them for inflation. So the corporate class is really rolling in it, but they're not spreading the wealth around very much. So the rate of profit this time has been very, very greatly boosted by austerity for the rest of us. Good news if you're a corporation or a shareholder. Not so good if you're an ordinary working American. And let's see, a couple of quickie looks at the other economic indicators. Existing home sales in the month of August rose. That is, sales of existing houses rose by 2 million to an annual rate of a bit over 7 million, pretty close to their all-time record, which was set last June. But sales of new houses declining in the month of August. So we're getting a mixed picture. That's actually taking a pretty steep decline in the month of August. So we're getting a mixed picture in the state of the housing market. It looks to me like the great upward acceleration, the stratospheric move in the housing market in the United States is really coming to an end. Interest rates are rising. The economy seems to be running out of some steam, and it's beginning to show in the housing market. Also, the Mortgage Bankers Association's weekly tally of mortgage applications falling in the last week, further evidence that, and actually pretty well off its summer peak. So it does. That's further evidence, I think, that the housing market is beginning to cool. The Conference Board, the business-sponsored research group, reporting that its tally as measure of consumer confidence took a very, very, very steep dive in September. And this suggests that high gas prices and just the general sense of despair around the hurricanes and political drift does seem to be taking its toll on consumer attitudes. Now, it's not clear if that's going to mean that people will borrow less and spend less, but it is a very cautionary sign. And also, as part of that survey, Conference Board asks people what they think of the job market, and the share of the population thinking that jobs are plentiful fell by more than 3 percentage points, and those that think they're hard to get rose by more than 2 percentage points, so deteriorating perceptions of the job market. And that confirmed by the Conference Board's measure of the Help Wanted ads. They look at about 30 newspapers around the country measure the amount of Help Wanted ads. Now, this has been undermined somewhat because of the growth of Internet web postings for the jobs of replacing newspaper Help Wanted ads. But the month-to-month movements are probably a good idea, a good measure of what's going on with the employer's hiring intentions. That falling very steeply in August to the lowest reading it's seen since before the recession hit. So this is in 2001. So it's rising gas prices, no doubt, perhaps the effects of Hurricane Katrina, although perhaps it's a little early for that to be showing in that number. But in any case, the job market looking a little weaker. Also, the Labor Department's measure of weekly jobless claims, the number of people who have lost their jobs and signing up for the first time for unemployment benefits, falling by a pretty steep 79,000 last week. But there's some really funny things. All the economic numbers are hard to read now because of the effects of Hurricane Katrina. But it could be that the processing, considerable processing delays in the storm-ravaged areas. So that decline may or may not be significant, but it's still higher level than what we've seen in some time. And the four-week moving average, which is used to smooth out the effects, rising to 386,000. And the number of people continuing to draw unemployment benefits also rising by a very substantial 144,000. So further sign that the job market may be cooling down and perhaps heading south. And finally, the Economic Cycles Research Institute's weekly leading index also falling last week. Continuing a pattern of weakening over the last several weeks. The future of the U.S. economy looking a little less bright. But it's going to be hard to read that in the coming weeks. Let's take a little musical break, and we'll be back with Kurt Davies.
Yeah.
And that little excerpt from the song Flood Victim by Pavement from their Crooked Rain album, Crooked Rain, Crooked Rain, L.A.'s Desert Origins, a blast from the hipster past from 1994. And speaking of floods and all, we're now joined by Kurt Davies, who is a research director at Greenpeace based in Washington. And welcome to WBAI, Kurt.
Thanks. Nice to be here.
So, first of all, let me get your opinion on this. What was the contribution of global warming or climate change, whatever you want to call it precisely, to Hurricane Katrina? And is this a foretaste of things to come?
Certainly the latter. It's very difficult at this point to pin any one weather event on global warming. And scientists are telling us that in the future, as warming proceeds and the oceans absorb that heat, and sea surface temperatures rise, that these storms will get stronger and meaner and fatter. But no one can say that Katrina or Rita was caused by global warming. Was it enhanced by global warming? Were these events worse than they would have been? We probably won't know that for many years and many years of study. But it certainly is not a good thing if it's a taste of the future, and that's what scientists are predicting with global warming, more extreme weather.
Well, we did see a story on the front page of the New York Times today about melting polar ice caps, now perhaps entering a vicious cycle stage where the melting ice increases the amount of water, the water increases the amount of heat trapped on the Earth. So is this are we in some sort of carousel to catastrophe here?
We are in a very bad place with global warming, and I think the scientists are even being caught by surprise. That study came out of the National Snow and Ice Data Center in Colorado. And what they've been doing is measuring the minimum of the ice every summer. And this is the record minimum ice. So it's the worst meltdown on the North Pole ever seen. That means that the snow, the ice that develops this winter, will not likely rebound to a level to sustain it. And we could be in a negative feedback, meaning it's self-perpetuating. You have more open water. It's a dark color. It's not ice. It absorbs the sun's heat, accelerating the warming. It's not a good thing at all.
And the map that accompanied that article in the Times, which had an outline of where the ice was, I think in the early 90s, comparing it to where it is now, it's for a 10-year period, it looks like a very gigantic recession in the ice.
Yeah, and it's that was showing the average ice over the past 30 years, or up from the 70s through the 90s, and compared to today, and it is a major receding. Accompany that with record events all over the world, the melting of permafrost, the permanently frozen land in the tundra in Alaska and Siberia across Canada, record droughts, nasty floods across Europe and China this year. The superlatives start to stack up, and it's pretty unnerving, actually.
Yeah, one or two events could be just a random thing, but this is looking too much like a pattern.
Well, once again, you can't pin any one of these events, except in the heat wave in Europe last year, or a couple years ago, many thousands killed in France. Scientists have now ruled out everything but global warming as having possibly caused such a random event. That was a totally unprecedented event, not a 1 in 100 event, but a 1 in 1,000 event. And when those start stacking up, you get a wave of a shudder through the business industry, through the insurance industry, through governments of the world.
Yeah, and as we were talking on the phone yesterday, I was telling you, I went to a conference that Greenpeace co-sponsored with the insurance industry at the College of Insurance in downtown Manhattan, Greenpeace is trying to get the insurance business to care about climate change issues. Like I told you, what, 12 years ago, it looked like the two sides were talking different languages, just talking right past each other. The Greenpeace people were talking about the threat of environmental catastrophe, and the insurance people were talking about tighter building codes and financial innovation. Has the insurance industry come along at all in the last dozen years?
They certainly have. We've kind of followed that conversation, but have not been spearheading it as hard as we were in the early 90s when there were some good people here doing that work. And it kind of ended, as you said, in a conversation where we were speaking past each other, and the insurance industry, as I understand it, said, well, we'll just raise rates and change the way we structure ourselves. Now you have major insurance companies like Swiss Re and Munich Re, the reinsurers who insure the insurance companies, are sending out a warning that they can't cover the potential losses. There was a report issued in June by the Association of British Insurers that showed that losses from hurricanes, Japanese typhoons, windstorms in Europe are likely to increase by more than 60% in coming decades due to global warming. The National Association of Insurance Commissioners, the state insurance officials, were planning their annual meeting at the Sheraton in New Orleans, and it was canceled due to Katrina, and they had planned a session in that meeting about global warming. There was a report issued by CERES, a group up in Boston, CERES.org, on September 8th that showed a 15-fold increase in insurance losses due to climate events, weather events in the past three decades, and it was written by insurance industry officials. So certainly the industry is waking up to this threat. Whether they will adapt to it or whether those losses, I mean, certainly those losses get passed on to all of us, so it affects everybody.
Well, you mentioned the reinsurance companies, Swiss Re and Munich Re, and the listeners may not know what reinsurance is. It is, as the name suggests, when insurance companies write a policy, they often will take out insurance against having to pay it off, and so they go to a reinsurer to insure right. themselves. So the reinsurance industry, in some sense, is really the last bearer of risk for some of this stuff. But it does seem that the Europeans, you mentioned the British as well, it does seem the Europeans seem to be a little more concerned about this than their American counterparts. Is that a correct impression?
Yeah, I think that's true. And, that's what we were trying to stimulate in the early 90s with this dialogue with the U.S. insurance industry, also trying to get them to take a more political role because, of course, the insurance industry is an enormous political lobbying and contributing force in politics in this country. And counterbalanced by the oil industry and the coal industry, who in the early 90s were putting out major campaigns to stop the Kyoto Protocol, to stop any global treaty on global warming, to foil everyone into thinking that global warming didn't exist. And, you know, we wanted to see if the insurance industry, who really stands to lose bad from this, could throw their weight around, but they chose to duck, I think. I think you're seeing Wall Street wake up to global warming. You're seeing more and more the investment community realize that this is a big issue and has to be considered. And I think eventually there's going to be one or two American insurance companies who are going to turn the corner and kind of be like the Brown and Williamson in the tobacco industry, the first ones to admit that smoking causes cancer.
Yeah, I noticed there was an item on the Bloomberg Wire a day or two ago.
Yeah,
saying that some of the Wall Street analysts were taking notice of the global warming risks. So,
it was an amazing piece. It's an amazing story.
Yeah, it was quite something, considering the source. if they are starting to take notice, will the political system start taking notice, or is there just too many interests stacked against it?
Well, it already has. I mean, there indeed is progress. You're probably, you know, your listeners know that the Bush administration pulled us out of the Kyoto Protocol. We're doing nothing at the federal level to solve this problem. But the state of New York, for example, is doing a lot. They're doing greenhouse gas reductions and aggressive renewable energy targets. All of New England has joined together. The eastern states have joined together in a collective effort. The western states have joined together in a collective effort. Various cities are doing their own programs. It's just the Fed that's behind. But even there, you have the Senate recently. There was a good bill Senator McCain and Lieberman put up, and it was great until they decided to include nuclear energy in it, and then they lost all the support of the environmental community. But there are efforts brewing, and Bush is being left in a corner with his cohorts at Exxon and the other naysayers on this, and pretty soon that position is going to be so untenable that we hope it becomes a political problem, as it was for Bush in 2001 before the horror of September 11th. Hit and raised his ratings. He was had pretty low ratings, specifically on environmental issues.
Weirdly, though, I think that there was a poll showing that something like two-thirds of Bush voters thought he supported the Kyoto Protocol. So,
yeah.
God knows what people were thinking when they pulled the lever. I should say I was speaking with Kurt Davies, who is the research director at Greenpeace in Washington. We've got gas prices, they were briefly above $3. Now they're just a little below $3 a gallon. Is this going to have an effect one way or the other? I noticed that the first thing the administration did was talk about loosening environmental regulations.
Well, you know, amazingly, this week Bush talked about conserving energy, and the speech that came out.
It looked like it was really hard for him to say those words.
It sounded like he was forcing himself, but you know, reminded people of Jimmy Carter sitting down in his sweater in front of the fireplace in the 70s. I think that you know the reality has hit them, and he's even said recently that our dependence on foreign oil is a national security issue, almost connecting oil to the war in Iraq, which we all know is a connection to our involvement in the Middle East for sure. We have a convergence now, left-right convergence on why are we dependent on oil, who's doing something to solve it. And I think it's not long before we can see some progress out of that. There just has to be. What you're seeing right now is people are trying to sell their SUVs everywhere. And there's a drop in sales. There's more sales of small cars. That's just self-interest. I mean, it's not an environmental motivation. It's economic preservation. You see more and more small trucks being driven by the FedEx and UPS guys, these diesel sprinters from Mercedes that get great mileage. You know, it will be a trend towards more efficiency because it just isn't good to have gas prices so high for business. Of course, higher gas prices, are around the world. We have the lowest gas prices of anybody, so it's kind of like we're just being, we're coming into reality now.
I don't want to say this is rearranging deck chairs in the Titanic because that's a dreadful cliche, but if I were about to say that, would we be doing that? I mean, what really is necessary to stop the polar ice caps?
It's a really good question. I mean, we've just come back this summer. Our ship, the Arctic Sunrise, which actually will be in New York City on Saturday and Sunday at Chelsea Piers. People can come down and get a tour of the ship and see some of the work we've done this summer on global warming. From 11 to 5 on Saturday and Sunday. It's frightening when you see it in person. And in fact, it is, you know, to be honest, very late. We caught this problem really in the 70s and 80s. Scientists woke up to it. It's taken 30 years for policymakers to catch up to the scientists. And it's almost like we've driven the truck off the cliff and now we're talking about brakes. But we have to do something. It doesn't mean you just stop working on cutting the pollution that's causing global warming, tuning up our cars, and pushing clean, renewable energy. We have to do that because we can still head off the worst of it if we do that. There is some warming that is inevitable. It's already in the system. Of course, we can't shut down our energy infrastructure tomorrow. We'd all starve, and it wouldn't work. But we know that there's a transition that has to happen. The sooner the better, and we certainly can't stop working on it.
Well, give us an idea of the kinds of measures we need to take just to get a start on this.
Well, the easiest things that are off the shelf and cheap and affordable now are energy efficiency and renewable energy. Wind power, you know, there's a good project that's about to go in off of Long Island. There's one that's proposed off of Cape Cod in New England. There's tons of wind being born on land in the mountains and across the plains. Solar energy is completely untapped, and it's becoming more and more affordable as other forms of energy become more expensive. And then energy efficiency, just tuning up your own house and your appliances. When you buy a new appliance, buying an Energy Star appliance, when you buy a new car, buying a good, clean car, all those things make a difference and make our entire economy more energy efficient, which cuts down on global warming pollution.
Oh, well, of course, the wind issue, nobody wants to live near a windmill, so how do we get past the NIMBY problem?
Well, you know, that's a bit of a it often pops up, but what we look at is the big picture, and you have, you know, certain people on the Cape, a lot of people on the Cape embracing it and saying, hey, if we don't do anything about global warming, Cape Cod, Nantucket, Martha's Vineyard are going to be very different places. It's predicted that Boston's going to have the climate of Atlanta by the end of this century if we do nothing, and Manhattan, New York will have the climate of Miami. So you're not ready for that, and New England certainly isn't ready for that kind of heat either. So they know that if you don't do anything, you're going to have hell to pay. And this is, you know, a reality check. Do you want that in your backyard, or do you want more nuclear power or another coal plant causing asthma and causing mercury pollution? We have real tough choices to make, but we think the obvious choice is clean energy.
Well, as I recall, the Kyoto requirement is to get several percentage points below 1990 emissions levels, right?
So, yeah, that's the first level of commitment. People shouldn't really dwell on that, because the real importance of Kyoto is it sets up the architecture for dealing with this problem. And within the Kyoto Protocol, they have to respond to the scientific evidence at hand. And every 5 years, every year really, but every 5 years, the scientists of the world issue a report that's about the size of 3 phone books that gives the state of play. What do we know about the science? The policymakers are obliged to reply to that with policy measures. So the next level of cuts, the first cuts that were negotiated in 97 were small, were way too small to really do effectively control global warming. The next level of cuts have to be a lot deeper, and that will be starting, the negotiations will be starting in Montreal this November and December. So you're going to see, hopefully, really good incentives within that for cleaner energy and energy efficiency, all the things I've been talking about.
Well, what struck me about that, though, is that getting back to a little below 1990 levels doesn't seem, on the face of it, an insuperable task. I mean, we were pretty profligate back in 1990. But yet our political system couldn't really handle it. How can we get serious?
It's going to take a lot, and it's going to take a full-on effort and both sides of the aisle cooperating. Right now we have very aggressive and effective lobbying by the oil industry, by the auto industry, electric utilities, to stop anything from happening in Congress. And in the end, it can be done. Many groups, and Greenpeace included, have done reports showing that how many jobs can be created through such an energy efficiency, a clean energy campaign to build jobs in the U.S. I mean, the U.S. should be exporting all this technology to the rest of the world. Instead, we're falling behind. So we think there's a really hopeful future, and a future where we're building cars you don't have to fill up, and houses you don't have to pay bills on. But it takes doing, and it's going to take some money. But the longer you wait, like Social Security, if you don't pay it now, you're going to pay more later. And so we've been pushing this for decades, and I think finally there's some action happening. Like I said, the state level, New York's doing really progressive work, and you should be proud of that. And it's going forward. You know, the momentum is in favor of better and better things happening on the policy level.
All right, and repeat when your ship is going to be docking at Chelsea Piers this
weekend? Yeah, it'll be open on Saturday and Sunday, I think 11 to 5, where you can take a tour and see some of the displays of some of our work, and our staff will be there to tell you about what we do. And you can see all of what we do on greenpeaceusa.org, and we need your support. Thanks a lot.
Well, thank you for joining us, Kurt Davies, who is the research director of Greenpeace, and I certainly admire the work you're doing.
Thank you.
And let's take a little break, and we'll be back to hear from Larry Bartels.
Hi, I'm Danny Glover, and this is WBAI, listener-supported, non-commercial radio in New York.
Come on, neighbors, let's get wise.
So, the plaster is falling, the paint is peeling, the plumbing is leaking, the heat and hot water keep cutting off, the elevator keeps breaking down, and the landlord won't return your calls, but the rent keeps going up and up and up.
Find out what you can do about it. Tune in to Housing Notebook, Mondays at 8 p.m.
And we're back here behind the news. My name is Doug Henwood. And now, an interview recorded yesterday with Larry Bartels, who is a professor of political science at Princeton University. He wrote a paper which was delivered at the American Political Science Association's annual meeting at the beginning of September, called What's the Matter with Kansas? And you can find the paper on the web by, it's a very long mouthful, but just look for Larry Bartels, B-A-R-T-E-L-S, and his homepage at Princeton will show up on the third or fourth Google listing, so you can find the paper that way. What's the matter with Kansas? And of course, Tom Frank. And I should say, I admire Tom Frank's work a lot. I'm very fond of him personally, and he's a very great writer and a very admirable character. So I want to make that clear from the outset. But some of the claims he makes in the book, I think, do need to be looked at carefully. He argues, as many of you probably already know, that there's any, as he calls it, a new dominant political coalition that unites business and blue collar, that in increasing increasingly conservative Republican Party. The result of this new coalition is, as he puts it, a populist uprising that benefits only the people it is supposed to be targeting. Assortment of millionaires and lawyers and Harvard grads who get elected to office and push tax cuts, deregulation, free trade, and corporate welfare. And as he puts it, all the working class cultural conservatives who vote for this stuff end up with lower wages, more dangerous jobs, dirtier air, a new overlord class that comports itself like King Farouk, and, of course, a crap culture whose moral freefall continues without significant interference from the grandstanding Christers whom they send triumphantly back to Washington every couple of years. But how much of this is actually true? The Frank book is based on an examination of Kansas, but has the white working class moved to the right? Has it abandoned the Democratic Party, and has it embraced this conservative agenda? So let's listen to Larry Bartels and find out.
So, Larry Bartels, we're familiar with the argument that cultural issues have driven a good bit of the white working class to the right, that they're voting against their material interest and moving Republican on the basis of abortion and homosexuals and all those sorts of things. Is there any truth to the argument?
There's not much truth to the argument as you've just presented it. It seems to me that the part of Frank's story that rings true is the part that has to do with elite politics, and maybe especially with the factional structure within the modern Republican Party, where I think social issues have become relatively more important, and the activists who are conservative on social issues have come to play an increasingly large role. But if you look at the electorate as a whole, it's less obvious, and in particular, I think, if you look at people who are towards the bottom of the income distribution, who are the kinds of people that Frank seems mostly to be talking about, it turns out not to be the case at all that they've moved in the way that he suggests.
Reading the Stonecash books, Jeffrey Stonecash books several months ago, I was struck by how it undermines an article of faith among liberals and leftists that the Democratic Party has moved substantially to the right. He somewhat dissents from that, but also points to the fact that what's really the outstanding thing in American politics over the last couple of decades is what's happened with the Republican Party. Do you concur with that?
I think, again, you have to distinguish between what's going on at the elite level and what people are reading about in the newspapers in terms of policy shifts in Washington and what's going on in terms of the policy views among ordinary people. It's always hard to chart these things effectively, but in the cases where we do have survey data going back for decades asking people the same questions over and over, it's very rare to see much significant movement one way or the other in their views about policies. On the other hand, there's been a pretty substantial shift in terms of elite positions on some important policy issues.
All right, well, let's go through some of your findings one by one. First of all, has the white working class, and I suppose we should ask you how you define the white working class, has the white working class abandoned the Democratic Party in significant numbers?
My answer to that question is no. This does depend some on how you define terms. The particular definition of the working class that I picked is a pretty straightforward one, but not one that's universally accepted among people who talk about these issues and have looked at the data on these issues. What I'm doing is classifying people on the basis of family income levels and comparing especially what's going on among people in the bottom third of the income distribution and among people in the middle and top thirds of the income distribution. Other people have looked at educational distinctions or people's subjective sense of their social class or at what kinds of occupations they have. All of those, I think, are problematic in a variety of ways, especially in terms of doing these kinds of long-term comparisons. What it means to be college educated, I think, is quite different now than it used to be. What it means to have a blue-collar job is, I think, socially and economically quite different than it used to be. So I'm simply dividing people up on the basis of their income levels and looking at the extent to which their position in the income distribution seems to affect their partisan views and their voting behavior. And if you do that, it turns out that the white working class, that is whites in the bottom third of the income distribution, actually vote more reliably Democratic for president now than they did 50 years ago.
And what about their brethren up the social ladder?
The middle class and upper class have both shifted toward the Republicans. So there has been an erosion in overall support for Democratic presidential candidates, leaving aside the fluctuations from one election to the next on the basis of the quality of candidates and things like that. There has been a long-term decline in Democratic voting among the middle and upper class whites, but not among the whites in the bottom third of the income distribution. They've actually become more Democratic over time.
And then what about, you look also at some kinds of policy questions. What about those general questions about inequality and employment and such?
Well, what I've done there is to look at a series of policy questions that have been repeated in national surveys over the last 30 years or so to look for movement in people's views on these questions. And it turns out that there's really very little. Among people in the bottom, among whites in the bottom third of the income distribution, they're continually a good deal more moderate, which is to say less conservative on economic issues than middle and upper class whites are. They're more moderate, which is to say less liberal on social issues than middle and upper class whites are. So they're kind of trailing along pretty consistently in the middle of the distribution on both of those broad sets of policy issues without any shift either in their absolute position or in their position relative to people higher up the income ladder.
And what about the relation between what we call the economic issues and the social issues? Does one trump the other? Does one have an influence on the other? What's the relation?
Well, there's a positive relationship between people's views about economic issues and their views about social issues in general. Of course, there are some people who have different combinations of views than those typical ones. So there's been a lot of focus among political observers and political strategists on people who have relatively liberal economic positions and relatively conservative positions on social issues or vice versa. But the most typical pattern is for people either to be relatively liberal on both kinds of issues or relatively conservative on both kinds of issues. And then the question that I look at is, to what extent do those kinds of views seem to be shaping their party identifications and their voting behavior? And the answer turns out to be that although the import of social issues seems to have been increasing pretty substantially over time, it's still the case for most people that economic policy views are more important in shaping their overall political beliefs and their voting behavior than their views about abortion and other social issues are. And that to the extent that the weight that people seem to attach to those social issues has increased over time, the increase has come much more among people in the middle and top of the income distribution than among the kinds of people that Frank is talking about.
Are there any regional patterns to what you're talking about?
Well, the main shift, the kind of big headline in American politics over the last 50 years has been what's happened in the South. I think a lot of liberal observers think back to the good old days in which there was a solid liberal majority for policy shifts. The Democratic Party was kind of the natural majority party. That view, I think, ignores the extent to which the Democratic majorities of the period were dependent upon the unnatural Democratic monopoly in the South stemming from the Civil War and the Jim Crow era. And what's happened over the last 50 years is that unnatural monopoly in the South has eroded. There used to be a huge Democratic advantage in both party identification and presidential voting behavior in the South. That's dissipated entirely, gradually and steadily over the last 50 years, so that now the pattern in the South looks much like the pattern in the rest of the country, which is to say that it's quite evenly divided between Democrats and Republicans. And so we're in a position that in some sense you might say is the natural position to expect in a majoritarian two-party kind of system, which is that the parties are roughly equally divided. Elections tend to be pretty close. Either side can win.
And what about Kansas itself? Tom Frank makes a big deal out of how Kansas was once the hotbed of populism and other kinds of working class and farmer rebelliousness, and contrast that to its present republicanism. But what's happened in the intervening period?
Well, Kansas has been a very Republican state for a long, long time. He doesn't focus so much on that. What's changed, I think, is the factional conflict within the Republican Party in Kansas. But if you try to hark back to the period when Kansas was a competitive state, you have to go back a long, long time in political history. And so the main issue with respect to national politics, which has to do with the relative strengths of the Democratic and Republican Party and the kind of people that they're appealing to, is really, I think, largely beside the point in terms of understanding what's happening on the ground in Kansas.
I'm speaking with Larry Bartels, a professor of political science at Princeton and author of a recent paper on the political allegiances and beliefs of the white working class.
You don't write about this in your paper, but I'm sort of curious. Have you looked at all at turnout? Are working class whites any more or less likely to vote than they once were?
I've looked at this a little bit. It appears as though the pattern of differential turnout with respect to income is really maintained itself pretty much over time. There was a significant decline in overall turnout in the 1960s and early 1970s that was counterbalanced to some extent by an increase in turnout in the South, especially among African Americans who were really only at that point becoming enfranchised and able to vote, but also there was a good deal of mobilization of white voters or counter-mobilization of white voters in the South through that period as well. So through that period, there's a kind of equalization of turnout between regions, but an overall decline. What people often don't grasp, I think, is that in the last 30 years or so, there's really been no overall trend in turnout one way or the other. Once 18-year-olds were enfranchised in the early 1970s, the turnout rate has remained relatively stable as a proportion of the eligible population. What's happened is that the standard calculation that the Census Bureau puts out, which is the number of voters as a fraction of the voting age population, is increasingly unrepresentative because there are more and more people included in the denominator of that calculation who aren't eligible to vote, especially people who are non-citizens. So turnout has, in fact, remained pretty stable over the last 30 years, and the disproportional share of turnout coming from the middle and upper classes has remained pretty consistent over that period as well.
What do you make of the corollary of the Frank argument that the Democratic Party has abandoned or even betrayed its natural constituency, the working class?
Well, I think there's a sense in which the Democratic Party has moved to the right on some economic issues, especially. I think that's a accommodation in part to the nature of the times, external economic pressures and technological change. In part, I think, maybe mistaken calculations about the party's short-term electoral interests. But I don't think it's right as a summary of the kinds of people that the party has succeeded in appealing to. It's still the case that the core of Democratic support comes from people who are in the bottom part of the income distribution rather than in the top part. It's still the case that those people, to the extent that they have Democratic loyalties and tend to vote for Democratic candidates, do so mostly on the basis of economic issues. And I think as a result, it would probably be a strategic mistake for the party to abandon its traditional working class economic appeals. On the other hand, in the kind of situation that I described where the two parties are pretty evenly matched and both sides are scrambling to pick up adherents at the margin, the question is either party better off trying to appeal to people on social issues who might not be in their coalition on the basis of economic issues? And so Frank castigates the Democratic Party for attempting to appeal to affluent suburbanites on the basis of their relatively liberal positions on social issues and claims that as a result of that, they've lost working class support. I'm trying to argue here that They haven't lost working class support. They have succeeded in attracting some of those upper class people on the basis of social issues, but not so many as you would guess from his argument. On the other hand, the Republicans are trying to appeal to people in the bottom part of the income distribution on the basis of their conservative social positions, and they've had less success at that than you would expect from Frank's account as well.
You've also looked at a lot of public opinion data on inequality and things like that. And first of all, there's a general impression that Americans don't care too much about inequality as a political or social issue. Is that true?
They mouth concern sometimes about inequality in the abstract. I think when it comes to actual policy issues, it's kind of a mixed bag. One of the things that I found striking in looking at these data was that there seems to be a good deal of support for a more progressive general tax policy. If you ask people, for example, about the how they feel about the tax burdens of rich people and poor people, they're much more likely to say that the rich should pay more in taxes than they do and that the poor should pay less in taxes than they do. But at the same time, there was a great deal of public support for President Bush's tax cuts in 2001 and 2003, which had exactly the opposite effect. If you look at people's views about inheritance taxes, they've always been quite opposed to the idea of taxing inheritances on death. Some people, I think, view that as a clever public relations success by conservative interest groups and Republican politicians over the last half dozen or dozen years. But to the extent that we know anything about people's views about that tax specifically, it appears that it's been quite unpopular over a very long period of time in American history.
Why is that? The estate tax applies to such a small percentage of the population, only to very rich people. Why is this general perception of dislike of it and the feeling that it may actually hit some people it wouldn't come near hitting?
Well, I think partly there's misinformation about the nature of the tax and how likely it is that people would actually be directly affected by it. I think partly there's a kind of particular ghoulishness about this particular kind of tax hitting people at a moment when they're already bereaved. But I think much of it has to do with the way in which opposition to the inheritance tax fits into a broader American mythology about opportunity and about being able to work and amass wealth and pass it along to your children within the family. And many people who are in other respects quite supportive of progressive taxation somehow think that that particular kind of progressive taxation is illegitimate.
And finally, I want to talk a bit about the relation between policy ideas and people's voting behavior. The Program in International Policy Attitudes at the University of Maryland did a poll before last year's election showing that a large portion of Bush voters thought he supported the Kyoto Protocol, for example. There are a whole lot of misperceptions about just what Bush supported and didn't. You also mentioned how people have feelings about progressive taxation, but that doesn't necessarily lead to influencing their vote. Do people vote on policy issues, or is something much more complicated at stake when they decide who to vote for?
I think some people vote in significant part on the basis of some fairly accurate perception of the candidate's positions on issues. I think for most people, though, it's more common for them to shape their views about the candidate's stance largely on the basis of preferences that they develop for other reasons. For example, there are strong correlations between people's views about specific issues and their overall partisan loyalties or party identification. One way to think about that is that you add up your positions on a bunch of issues and decide whether you should be a Republican or a Democrat. But to the extent that we can tease these things out of the survey data, it looks at least as common or more common that people develop these partisan attachments because of their liking or disliking for particular political figures or because of family traditions or social influences, and then gradually adopt positions on policies that are consistent with those partisan loyalties rather than the other way around. And there are a lot of people who vote largely on the basis of some feeling about the state of the country, whether things are going well or badly at a particular time, which again are shaped in significant part by their basic partisan loyalties. So if you ask a typical Republican and a typical Democrat how things are going in Iraq or how the economy is doing, you're likely to get very different answers because they're filtering their perception of events through these partisan lenses.
We see the President Bush's approval rating now down around 40%, which is quite low by historical measures. We also see a very high positive response to a sense that the country is off in the wrong direction. We're getting close now to late 1970s levels. How are we to read these numbers? How are we to understand them? What kind of longer-term political significance do these have, if any?
I'm not sure what the longer-term political significance is. One of the things that I find a little bit mysterious about American politics is how much the elite politics at any given moment are shaped by these kinds of numbers. So if the president's poll numbers are up, it's relatively easy for him to push his policy agenda, and he has more influence in Washington than when his numbers are down. One way to think about that is that all of these politicians are looking forward to the next election. But the fact is that the poll numbers are sufficiently subject to change that how they stand now probably isn't very indicative of how things will be at the time of the next election anyway. So I think much of what's going on here is a kind of shared perception among the elite community about whether the president is in a position that demands political deference or not. In this case, I think there was a kind of slacking of political momentum almost immediately after the president's reelection. That's not uncommon for second-term presidents, but then that's been exacerbated by the problems in Iraq and by the fallout from Hurricane Katrina in ways that I think have exacerbated what's a kind of typical historical problem for second-term presidents.
And that was the voice of Larry Bartels, a professor of political science at Princeton University, talking about some of his research, particularly a paper he recently wrote called What's the Matter with Kansas, which you can get from his website. I don't want to recite a long URL, but if you Google the name Larry Bartels, B-A-R-T-E-L-S, you will find about three or four entries down the name, his Princeton University homepage. And from that, you can find the paper. So that's it for me, Doug Henwood. Stay tuned for the news. I'm not sure exactly when I'm going to be back with fundraising in the future. But let's go out with a little bit of The Price of Gas from the band Block Party. That's Block without a K. Block Party, The Price of Gas. Till whenever. Goodbye.